All right, we got you, Joe. Thank you for signing in. We're running two experiments tonight. Number one, we're about to find out, is there anybody besides Joe who's not watching the Academy Awards and is willing to sign into the TechNet? We might have a very light night because not very many people will sign in. We'll soon find out. And we're also going to be making a change that has been suggested by a number of people who are afraid of missing some portion of the TechNet, and therefore they stay to the end, and midnight is a little bit late for them, so they're going to have a bloodshot eye the next morning. So at the suggestion of Paul and Roy and others who signed in, we're going to stop the TechNet from being 4 hours per night, and we're going to make it 3 hours tonight. Each individual section will start off approximately 1 hour long, 1 hour for questions, answers, and comments, 1 hour for the mailbag and science talk, and 1 hour for the space report. So we'll be ending at 11 o'clock, but tonight with the Academy Awards, maybe we'll be ending earlier than that. And as usual, Roy has got a nice puzzle for us, and Paul has got some interesting launches to tell us about. Let me drop. So as you guys have heard so many years, TechNet is here for educational purposes. We amateurs teach each other what we've learned as we do our experimenting with ham radio. As we discover how these antennas really work and whatever, and if it's real light tonight, maybe I'll give a little bit of a talk on what's the real meaning of effective area of an antenna. That's not clear in any of the books that I can read on it from my point of view. Okay, so now's the time to check in. If you've got a question or a comment for us, please give us your call letters and your name with the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. K2 Romeo India Whiskey, TechNet, we're listening. I told you. the Academy Awards is really sucking people up tonight as a guess. So anyone to check into the technical net, because you do have a question or a comment, please give me a call letters and name for right now.
WA2VDH, John, yes.
WA2AXO, comment. Name's Paul.
Okay, very well done, both of those guys, both John and Paul. VDH and AXO. Haven't heard from you for quite some time, Paul. Glad to hear you. And, Paul, a quick question to you. Your comment, is it a point of order that we should put up front, or should we just put you in order for you to make your comment? To V2AXO, K2RIW.
Yeah, just a comment on delivery of some amateur radio equipment that's been slow. Go ahead.
Okay. We'll be hearing about that. So apparently, I'm guessing you ordered something. So we've got Joe, John, and Paul in that order. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Because you're one of those brave people that's not watching the Academy Awards. So if you got a question, comment, or whatever, give me a call letter and name right now. K2RIW listening.
N2OEG, no question. Gerard.
Name is Brandon, KP1THM, and yes.
Okay. Gerard is N2 OEG, I think it was. And Brandon, KD1, I'm having trouble reading my writing. Thomas, Hotel, Mike, is that what your call letters were, Brandon? Brandon, are your call letters Kilo, Delta, 1, Thomas, Hotel, Mike? Go ahead.
No, Kilo Bravo 1, Tango Hotel Mike. I'm on Echo Link, so there's a little bit of a delay.
Glad you told me that, Brandon, so we'll make sure we give you extra time to when I come back to you and so on. All right, Joe was first. Joe sometimes asks us some pretty deep science questions. We'll find out his propagation experiments that he quite often runs. Let's see how he's doing with that. WA2RYY. KTRYW. You got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, and the TechNet, WHYYY. Well, this is a component question, and I haven't seen this rating on parts in a while, but I just happened to pick up one that's actually used, is actually being thrown out. It's a capacitor, must come out of a power supply, fairly big, like 16,000 microfarad, 40 volt DC. But here's my question on the rating. It says 16,000 UV, 40 volt, 40 BBC, minus 10%, plus 75%. I thought when they make these capacitors, they pretty much know by the material they use to make it and the dielectric of the material between the conductors of how much capacity they'll get in a particular package. Why is the rating 10? I could probably see allowing for parts of, you know, exactly, components is the material used inside. But plus 75%, why would the capacitor have that kind of rating? Back to you, Dick.
I'm with you, Joe. When it comes to the dielectric material you're going to pile between the two plates, you can easily measure its dielectric constant. And once you know the dielectric constant and the area of the plates, you multiply the two together, and you get microfarads. However, the real area of the plates of an electrolytic capacitor are a hell of a lot more in square inches or square centimeters than what you see. If you had a plate that was 2 inches wide and 2 inches high, and you got two of them sandwiched together, you would think you've got 4 square inches on each plate. However, the way they etch the plates makes hills and valleys, so that the total area of the plate is a hell of a lot larger. I am guessing the way they etch the plates gives them a considerable variable. So my guess is that the hills and the valleys of the etching at the microscopic level of the plate, which gives you the true area, in some cases many times the physical area that your eye would see that you would measure with a ruler, that's where I think they get the great big positive number. Notice the negative number, minus 10, you're not going to go down below no hills and valleys, so to speak. But you could, under some circumstances, depending on how the etching was done, get some very deep hills and valleys at the microscopic level, giving them a hell of a lot more capacitance. That's my guess as to what's happening. I'm going to pass it back to you, Joe, for comments. Drag your feet in case there's an electrolytic capacitor expert on board. Is going to give us better information than my guess. To B2RYY with a little delay. K2RYW in the TechNet.
No pickups. Interesting. Well, first of all, you enlightened me on something that I didn't realize, that they actually make the thing instead of more of just two flat plates rolled around like a big jelly donut, so to speak, that actually has hills and valleys on each part of the conductor to actually increase the area. That's an interesting concept, interesting way of manufacturing something. So, okay, that piece of information makes a lot of sense, and now I can understand why you might possibly have a big positive percentage number compared to this particular nominal rating on the component by itself. Interesting.
Also, when an electrolytic capacitor has sat dormant for, let's say, 6 months or longer, you shouldn't just go put a whole lot of voltage on it right away. You're supposed to slowly climb up on the voltage and reform the capacitor. That's the word they use sometimes, reform or re-electroplate. In other words, not only is the dielectric material coming in contact with the hills and valleys of the plate, but right at that interface, some form of third layer is built up of some kind of material. If the plate was aluminum and the dielectric material is capable of making an aluminum oxide, so the aluminum oxide plating of various thicknesses on the hills and valleys is another local material which that thin little plating, the formed capacitor, I am guessing also gives it a higher dielectric constant at the microscopic level in that area is what I think is going on. So the thickness of that extra plating that takes place in the forming process when they slowly climb up in voltage and charge the capacitor for the first time, that's another source of larger amounts of capacitance. My guess is if you've had a capacitor sitting dormant for 6 months and you only put 1 volt on it, you haven't really formed it yet, and you put a capacitance meter on it and measure the microfarads, and then you slowly climb up on the voltage and form it, and 24 hours later you measure the capacitance again, I am guessing you would measure a larger capacitance after a period of time when you reform that material on the interface between the juice that's in there plus and the plate and the hills and valleys. There's something else that goes on with the forming process. That's also, that forming process, there's some kind of a polarity-sensitive compound that takes place, obvious by the fact, let me drop, obvious by the fact that an electrolytic capacitor is extremely polarity-sensitive. One of the terminals is labeled positive, and the other one is labeled negative. And if you make the mistake of using the capacitor with opposite polarity, both tantalum capacitors and electrolytic capacitors, I think you're doing a destructive process when you do that. So there's more to the chemistry than first meets the eye. My guess is if you and I Googled electrolytic capacitors and Google enough variations of those words, we'd probably find out quite a bit more information along these lines, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, it starts making some more sense because I bought a capacitor meter from a UK company. I think it's, I think Andy has the same one. I can't remember exactly the name. It was like Pico something. And it's, you know, it'll measure fairly big capacitors. And I happened to measure a couple I had taken out of a power supply for attempting to repair, and I noted that the capacitor rating was about 50% bigger than what the capacitors actually said on the label, and it made me a little curious. And I wrote back to the manufacturer of the device itself and said, is this a normal reading? And the answer I got back is yes. Many times you'll see the reading, it could be 40, 50, 60% bigger than what the actual value is stamped on the part itself. So now it starts making a lot more sense. Back to you.
And that was probably a well-formed capacitor, wasn't that one that was sitting on the shelf for a year with no voltage on it, in which case I think the capacitance goes down for a while until you do the reforming process. Energy storage devices and these electrolytic capacitors, unfortunately, they're only good for a certain number of years, and then I think they dry out. The seal on them is not a hermetic seal, because under certain conditions there's some outgassing that takes place, and if it was a hermetic seal, the thing would be exploding. And I don't think they've gone through the effort of putting a spring and a valve, a safety valve. I don't think they've got a safety valve, but I'll bet you an electrolytic capacitor in general dries out by the time they're 10 years old and they need a complete replacement. In the old days, you could buy them from Radio Shack. I don't know where you buy them from today. Mallory makes some pretty nice capacitors, particularly the motor-rated capacitors, but those are AC capacitors. It's a different method of manufacture, I think. Thank you, Joe. Good question. And as you find out more about what's really going on at the microscopic level of the hills and valleys of the plate with that third coating of material that takes place in there, as you do any more research and find out what's going on, please come back and let us know what you discover. John is next, WA2VDH. What's your question tonight, John? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, say good evening to all in the TechNet.
My question has to do with the atomic clocks that that read WWVB at 60 kilohertz. I was just wondering if any other people on the net have noticed their clock malfunctioning or malreading, not reading correctly. I've been doing some monitoring of WWVB down there at Rock Bottom. Hi. Rock Bottom at 60 kilohertz, and I've noticed over the years the noise is really getting horrendous. I remember monitoring WWVB years ago with my Monster RBA-5 receiver that I somehow got home from Cortland Street. That's another story. But I've been monitoring it lately, and I noticed the noise level is really building up a lot down there. So I just my own atomic clock, my own clock is misreading quite a bit, and it's just started within the past couple of weeks. I thought maybe it was the bad battery, but it is the clock itself having a hard time, I think, distinguishing the signal there. And when I listen to WWVB, it's really down in the noise. So I was just wondering if any others are having that problem. Go ahead.
82 AM Zoo for comment. What a comment.
We've got AMZ with a comment and another person who said comment. We're going to pick up both of you in a second. In the old days, WWV, National Bureau of Standards, used to be, I can't name it, I remember the town, but in Maryland, not too far from Washington, D.C., so it was pretty close to us in the old days. Then they moved out to Boulder, Colorado. So they're another 1,500 miles, I'm guessing, further away from us. That's a contributing factor to them being noisier. Second of all, when it comes to frequencies like the 2.5 and 5 and megacycles that I listen to them on with my receiver, if I listen late at night, they're hearable. If I try to listen to them during the time the sun is up, the D-layer absorption is such that I cannot hear them. So by the time you're down to 60 kilohertz, I think you're getting more of that effect. What I'm saying is that they're far away, that makes them noisy. But if you do listening when the sun is up versus the sun is down, you're getting a huge difference. At midnight versus high noon, guarantee you, in one of those places, you probably will not hear the 60 kilohertz. In the other, it might sound better. So if you do some listening at sundown, near the transition zone, and during midnight and so on, so that would be a good thing to go and check on the whether or not the propagation is there at that frequency, at various sun angles, if you know what I mean. Okay, who is it? The first person, I said your call letters and I didn't write them down. OGB, I think it was. OGB, question mark, you're first, K2RIW.
RYY, I'm probably the second guy who made the comment.
Yeah, who was the first?
No problem, maybe me, KD2AMZ.
That's the one, KD2AMZ. Grid ahead.
KD2AMZ. For Christmas, I was given an MFJ-121B, local UTC clock, which are both clocks are synced to WWVB, and they've been working rock solid since Christmas, and they've been keeping perfect time since Christmas, because I compare the time to the internet time, and they're dead nuts on. So they set again after midnight when you got it's completely dark between Boulder and here in New York. It works. It works rather well. KD2AMZ.
WH4YY with a second comment on this. I have bought a couple of those battery-operated clocks. I've had them from years ago. The name on it is actually called Atomics. I actually have two of them. And they tell you in the instructions explicitly that try to place it near a large window. Apparently that must help with reception, and I've done that, and it does work. And they say expect to have better results after midnight.
WF2N.
That makes a lot of sense. So, Mike and Joe gave us quite a bit of information on this one. So, midnight, yeah, there's a huge difference. The when the sun is up, the ultraviolet coming out of the sun hits the atmosphere, gives you a very strong absorptive D layer. The layer of the ionosphere down low is very absorptive. And when the sun is there giving it juice, you get extremely short-range propagation at HF and lower frequencies. Beyond midnight, the D layer dissipates, and now you're getting real propagation off the upper ionosphere, E and F1 and F2 layers is my guess. Let's see. Paul, WS2N, give us your information. And what do you see? Are you seeing the 60 kilohertz WWV? Do you see them as not inaccurate? And by the way, when Joe was seeing them as inaccurate, it's possible the signal was so weak he was getting dropouts and therefore getting the wrong time indication. That's a guess on my part. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
For a lot of years, I've had one of these weather clocks. This one's by La Crosse. They used to advertise it all the time in QST, although I haven't seen it in there in quite a few years. But works good. It's got the atomic clock. But every year, I always change the batteries outside and inside. It transmits on 902, 903, just above the handband. And I look at it, and it's always dead on, like the other station said. The only time is when I change the batteries. It's in the daytime, and you set the clock. I set it manually as close as I can get. But then at nighttime, maybe within a few nights, it'll be right on, and then it will stay like that. But actually, I don't actually hear it. I don't hear it on a radio, but I could tell from the clock it works very, very good. Back to you, Dick.
My guess is, Paul, if you took out the battery at high noon and plug the battery back in where it's not getting the signal, you would not get the real good time. But if you wait until midnight, then it corrects itself and you get real good time. Is that possibly what you've experienced or what you could experience? Paul, go ahead.
Well, it always stays at the right time. Once it's set, I guess if it drifts one way or the other, at night it's going to pick up that signal and it's going to bring it back. Although I've never noticed that it's drifted because of that reason. So the only reason I change out the batteries is, it runs on two AA batteries outside, and then you have batteries on the inside. So the transmitter eventually quits, and you know that by looking at the outdoor temperature, and instead of seeing like 37.5 degrees right now, you just see it's blank. So you know that the batteries quit outdoors and it's time to change. It's usually once a year. But when I change it, it's in the daytime, and I won't notice it coming back until the next day, or sometimes a day or two later if I don't receive that signal in the middle of the night. And the directions say the same thing. It's in the middle of the night when you're going to receive the signal, due to propagation. Back to you there.
Katie, do AMZ.
Get back to you in a second, Mike. Paul, when you do see the time, so-called drift, a little bit inaccurate when you first change the battery, particularly in the daytime, and you know that the time you're reading is either high or low by some number of seconds or minutes, what are you using for a reference to find out its accuracy? Over to you, Paul.
Well, nowadays I just look at my UTC clock that's on a wall that I have pretty much calibrated with the 10,000 kilohertz, 10 megahertz on the handband. I still listen to that. They transmit at 2.5, 5, 10, and 15, and 20. Back to you there.
Tony B to JXM with a question.
JXM recognized. First is Mike. KD2AMZ, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Dick. For whatever it's worth, I'm actually looking at my MFJ clock, and it has signal bars. And when I first got it around Christmas time, it started out a bar or two. And right now, I'm looking at it, and it's got full bars, full signal strength. So I guess it's probably 5 o'clock out in Boulder right about now. So I'm guessing the sun is, like I said, the D-layer is probably gone between us and Colorado right now. But I'm right now receiving full bars.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed by that because it's sundown here. Let me think now. We've got roughly 8:25 here. It's only 6:25 in Boulder, but that's way beyond sundown. So the D layer has dissipated. That's what I think is going on. WV2JXM, is that Whiskey Bravo 2 Juliet X-Ray Mike? Correct me on that. And your name, sir? K2RIW. I should know you.
K2RIW in the group. Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Name is Rich. I know that very few, if any, of these atomic clocks are engineered this way, but would it be worthwhile to attach an external wire antenna to the clock to improve accuracy?
Now, that's getting into the effective capture area of an antenna that is or isn't resonant. To make an antenna on 60 kilohertz resonant, wow, you got to put a pretty big inductor in there. So the effective capture area of an antenna and what kind of signal-to-noise ratio you get out of it is a function of resonance. You can put a small clip lead onto the center conductor of your receiver and listen to an 80-meter signal, and that's the only antenna, this clip lead laying on a wooden table. And you'll hear signals, sideband signals, but they won't deflect the S-meter very much. You'll have 30 dB less deflection on the S-meter. Go to a full-size 80-meter dipole at a reasonable altitude, and you'll get a 30 dB stronger signal because it's resonant. Now, you could take that little clip lead, and with some difficulty, you could force it into electronic resonance at 80 meters, and it would make a huge difference. Boulder, Colorado, and 60 kilohertz is probably running lots of kilowatts of power, is my guess. That helps an awful lot. If the D-layer absorption is not taking place, and so you're getting a good propagation, that helps a lot. So the tiny little antenna that's in some of our appliances, under those conditions, is enough. And maybe they have forced it into a medium-low Q resonant, but maybe resonant. Those little tiny antennas you've got inside of your cell phone, there's an integrated circuit chip alongside of that antenna forcing into resonance on each one of the frequencies that it wants to listen to at that time. And so therefore, a small antenna in there can give them full performance. Let me drop.
KD2MZ for one other comment.
AMZ recognized. And the infinitesimal dipole is a chapter with that label on Krauss's book on antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill. And what John Krauss said is that as long as you're losing low-loss materials and you re-resonate the antenna, a dipole that used to be 132 feet long, and you make it 32 feet long or whatever, you make it infinitesimal in length, but keep the loss of the materials low, you never lose more than half a dB of signal strength. You're getting 90-some-odd% of the signal strength out of an antenna that's a couple of feet long instead of 132 feet long as you resonate it. And why that takes place, there's a whole fancy story on that one. Mr. AMZ, go right ahead, Mike.
Well, let me just follow up. I took one of these clocks apart when it died on me. It was a cheap one, and they use a ferrite rod antenna. It looks almost exactly like a your old transistor radio antenna. It's a little ferrite coil antenna that they used to use in old-fashioned transistor radios, if you can remember back. And when I was a kid, I used to be able to listen to AM stations. communications from across the country in my little six-transistor radio. So that's the kind of antenna I use, and it works quite well.
Yeah, if you and I were building a whip antenna, vertically polarized whip antenna for AM radio reception on an automobile, we got a very difficult environment there because the antenna is only a small fraction of a wavelength long, and to resonate it is difficult. And therefore, they use 90 ohm coax to the antenna, and there's a great big resonating coil inside of the radio itself with a frequency tracking function as you tune to higher and lower frequencies in the old days. To resonate it, you're going to put a great big inductor in there. Well, if you make the inductor out of a ferrite rod, you don't need the wire whip antenna anymore. The ferrite rod is now an H field, in other words, a magnetic field receptor instead of an E field receptor of the whip. And you can make a compact antenna with high efficiency a lot nicer with a ferrite rod. So the ferrite rod is resonating at the frequency you're using it at, and it's measuring the H field. In theory, the number of watts of power being transmitted in the E field and the H field are identical. The signal is really flipping back and forth between the two as it propagates. So whichever one you listen to, it's just a function of what technology you want to use for building that piece of hardware. And so at these HF frequencies, listening to the H field is a lot nicer. I am guessing that these clocks that we're talking about have a tiny ferrite rod in there that's doing the reception. So, and that ferrite rod, when resonated, will have the exact same effective capture area as the so-called infinitesimal dipole that is resonated. So a resonant structure, picking up either E field or H field or both, can give you a huge amount of area as long as you resonate it with low loss materials. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Mike. Ain't that crazy that a infinitesimal dipole, in theory, only has half a dB of loss, and the loss is not real loss. It's a slight change in the antenna pattern becoming a little bit more broad. So it's the exact same zero loss, slightly different antenna pattern broadside, giving you the half a dB of difference in signal strength. KD2AMZ, K2RIW.
VDH with final comments.
VDH recognized, but Mike first. Go ahead, Mike.
Again, agreed. That's exactly what it was back in the day. And I remember many a night, you know, listening to my transistor radio when you're under the covers. But that's exactly what it's, and by the way, they're very directional. The ferrite rod antennas, you have to kind of like broadside it to the source. But hey, it works extremely well. It worked that way back in the 60s, and it still works today. Hey, it works. What can I tell you? KD2AMZ.
WHYY had a question on this subject.
Okay. We're going to go to VDH and RYY in that order. In the old days, the AM broadcast was a vertically polarized E-field signal. The H-field was therefore horizontally polarized, and hopefully the loop, the ferrite loop in your transistor radio is horizontal when you mounted the radio in the usual manner. And broadside is the way it picks up the signal. And if you aim the end of the ferrite rod at the broadcast signal, you'd see a very deep null, which allows you to do direction finding if you want to. And if you turn the transistor radio 90 degrees, put it up on its side, so that the ferrite rod is now vertically polarized, again, except for being in a highly reflective environment, you would see a deep null in the signal. Okay, Mr. DDH first. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, what I've noticed is that the clock would acquire, it used to acquire a signal, you know, during the night, and during the day, maybe if it lost it, it would still run okay. But now it just seems to have a hard time acquiring at all. And I think it may be my local area here that I do have a very high noise level. I think it's due to a lot of the TVs in the area here with the various scan frequencies. Remember, I commented a few weeks ago when I was trying to monitor that station SAQ, that alternator station there in Sweden, down there at 17 kilohertz. And as I said, I think I have an extremely high noise level. So I think that might have something to do with it. Also, I have another question, if time permits. Go ahead.
Okay, right after Joe, we'll go to you. In Roosevelt, is there a whole lot of broadcast stations or something nearby? Is that what you believe the source of noise is? John, go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm not that far from HLI's transmitter site there near exit 20, but I do have a couple of solar rooftop solar installations, and I know they do give off quite a bit of switching noise. But from what I've listened to as I run my receiver around there, I hear the noise seems to have a periodicity to it, so I think it's multiples of the various scan frequencies, when they go to 1080i or 720p or whatever, the scan frequency shifts slightly, and I think that with all of the TVs in the area, I think it may be generating quite a bit of noise down there. I know the WWVB modulation is very slow amplitude shift keying. So it takes a while to actually acquire the time. I think it's got to listen for a couple of minutes to actually get what the time is and sync up. But it's been acting up lately. So I think it's my local noise level. Go ahead.
Because of your noise level, it cannot check out. It cannot synchronize itself with WWV. When you set the clock, I guess it slowly drifts at a rate that not being compensated. In other words, for the first couple of hours, if you set it, my guess is it's pretty good. But a day later, you've lost 20 seconds. Is that approximately what's happening? John, go ahead.
Oh, you don't set these clocks. They acquire the signal and set themselves. At least the one I have does it. And what I noticed is the other morning when I got up, it was just circulating around and around. And as I said, it did that once before, but usually during the night it would, lock up and have a good display for the entire day. But now it just seems to be drifting quite a bit. Actually, if you hold on a second, I could put I can get WWVB and you can see what kind of noise is on it. Go ahead.
Okay. Hold on. We're going to go over to Joe right now. W2RYY. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, being that these things probably use some sort of ferrite bar antenna, they'd have to use also some sort of capacity across that to make the thing into a resonant circuit at 60 kilohertz. Now, I don't think the ferrite bar would change inductance very much, but what about the capacity? Even if you changed it a couple of tenths of a picofarad for the total capacity that's being exhibited across this whole circuit to make it exactly resonant at 60 kilohertz, wouldn't that throw things off a little bit after a while if you had like a parts change just due to aging where your resonance is no longer at 60 kilohertz and maybe resonant to 70, 80, or maybe lower in frequency and not really right on the money? What do you think about that?
I'd like to believe they're using a quality capacitor so that it doesn't drift in time. Maybe it's a ceramic capacitor or one with polyethylene dielectric, something with or Teflon dielectric. It's probably a quality capacitor, not drifting, if there's a capacitor there at all. And it may be just a 40-gauge wire with so many turns that the self-resonance of the coil brings it to the right resonant frequency. Maybe no additional capacitor is added. That's another possible guess. And they wanted to, if it's listening to 60 kilohertz, you want it to resonate at 60 kilohertz, and maybe that resonance is a kilohertz or two wide. And so, therefore, it can tolerate a certain amount of drift before losing very much of the signal. It's a bunch of guesses on my part. I'm not really sure. Now, before we go over to John's second question, Paul had signed in, so let's go to Paul first. W-A-2-A-X-O. Paul? Paul number 2, W-A-2-A-X-O, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead with your comment, Paul.
Yeah, okay, Dick, thanks. I have a question about delivery of electronic equipment or goods from China. It looks like the distributors like DX Engineering, HRO, and a few others are having problems because I ordered an antenna, the X6000, and some other stuff, and they're having problems getting this stuff. So I just wonder if anybody had any experience from getting stuff direct from China. Go ahead.
This virus that they've got is now creating all kinds of restrictions in ships and planes and whatever going to and from China. So all of a sudden I can't remember the quote something or other virus. From the time the virus was discovered, which I don't know, maybe that was a year or so ago, I suspect that that happened before you placed your order. So that may be the reason, the lack of shipping, the lack of transportation to and from China is my guess. Over to you on that one, Paul. Drag your feet in case somebody's got some more information.
Okay, yeah, I ordered the antenna and a triplexer back in December last year, about 3 months ago, so... I have a, you're probably right, Dick. It probably is a, that situation has cropped up and it slowed everything down. All right. Well, that was my question, and if anybody has any input on that, I would appreciate it. Go ahead, Dick.
And this quarantine-like situation we've got now, Paul, is going to last a while. So I'm a little concerned that your shipment could be very delayed. And are they going to be able to find an alternate method of shipping to you, you know, by slow boat or something like that? But the shipping, I'm guessing, ordinarily takes place as cargo on an aircraft. And I think almost no aircraft are allowed to go to or from China these days, which is having all kinds of impacts. That virus is something terrible. The next person on our list, I think Gerald... was just signing in without a real question. I'll double-check with Gerald right now. N2OEG. Is that correct, Gerald? K2RIW. If you got a question, go ahead.
No question, just checking in. N2OEG.
Clear. I thought so, Gerald. Okay, Brandon is the next one. Kilo Bravo 1, Thomas Hotel Mike. Go right ahead, Brandon. K2RIW.
Hey, good evening, Rich. First of all, I just want to say I had a comment on the shipping from China. I believe they are also in observance of some type of holiday. I think it's Chinese Spring Festival. That was a message I had got from a seller on eBay. I had ordered something from China. They said January 19th through February 3rd. There may be a delay. Also, let me jump. So my question for you was about toroids. I'm attempting to build a bandpass filter, and this article I'm reading, it's from W3NQN, about a chip-shiv-style bandpass filter. It says it uses two resonators, and they're to be wound in a quadrifiler winding style, and I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around how to wind that. I've been doing some research on the internet and, you know, looking at various pictures and whatnot, and I'm just having a hard time understanding how you could have two wires for your primary and secondary windings, and then have them all wrapped together. I was just confused about that whole quadrifiler, and also they mentioned trifiler winding styles. Go ahead.
Very fine, Brandon. One of the things that's not good common sense is that taking two ordinary insulated wires and twisting them together, you end up with something in the vicinity of a 70-ohm twin lead when you do that, depending on how thick is the insulation and how tightly you wrap them. The tightness of the wrapping is a minor configuration, a minor change, but the thickness of the insulation is the major, and you end up in the vicinity of 70, 80 ohms. Those two wires twisted together make an extremely well-shielded transmission line, as long as you put the signal in correctly and take the signal out correctly as far as how you do the grounding, if you use it in a full differential manner. So you can wrap two wires together, three wires together, four wires together. You're getting a very good, well-defined impedance between the wires when you do that. Taking four wires and twisting them together first, then take that bundle of four wires and wind it the required number of turns around the toroid is what they're requesting you to do when they tell you to wind it in a quadrifiler manner. That's the first step. Four wires, hopefully four different colors. Red, green, blue, and orange, we'll say. You twist those four colored wires together, maybe with stripes on them, and then you take that bundle of four wires and wrap them the right number of turns on the toroid. Then, if there's a primary winding and a secondary winding, maybe the one of the ends of the red wire gets connected to one of the ends of the blue wire, and that series combination becomes the primary, and then the green and the yellow wire, the proper ends of those get wired together in series. And so once the whole bundle is wound together, you have to choose the right end of the right color and connect them to the other color in order to get a primary winding and a secondary winding. So there's a little bit of magic required there, and I'm a little bit afraid that Googling and finding the right article on how to do it, quite often there really is somebody who tells you how to build a filter out of toroids, and he really gives you good physical layout of the wiring as to which end of which wire gets connected where in order to make them in series. Let me drop. Now, to make them really act in series, let's see now that all four wires are wound around the toroid, and let's say in a clockwise manner. As such, if you choose the far end of the first wire, wire to the near end of the second wire, I believe that automatically forces those two wires to be in series, and that primary will now have twice the number of turns of the whole quadrifiler bundle, if you know what I mean. So as long as they are wired together polarity-wise, such that the second half of the primary is wound in the same direction as the first half, then the wires will add. If you make that incorrect, then you could get cancellation, and electronically you'll have the equivalent of zero turns on the primary. And there's a way you can check that. If you have an inductance measuring meter, and there's a way you can make homebrew circuitry to measure inductance, if you measure way low, way below the required amount of inductance, then you know if you get the polarity of that winding wrong. You wire it the other way, and you'll get a hell of a lot more inductance. So that's what's going on there. There's a whole art and science to trifiler and quadrifiler winding. You get a much more predictable, well-shielded toroid when you do it that way. But the first time you do it, it does seem a little spooky. KB1 THM with some delay for IRLP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's a very good explanation. I do understand what you're saying there. Now, maybe you'd be able to clarify this as well. So for the tri-filer winding, which is, I suppose, three wires, the primary would be the, maybe the first wire, and then the secondary would be the remaining two wires. This article I'm reading, it does have a schematic, but, again, no winding instructions and no close-up pictures of the toroid, so that was a little disappointing, but I'm attempting to figure it out, so. But I do understand what you're saying. That was a very good explanation. Thank you.
KD2AMZ, I was away for a minute. Were you trying to describe a 921 on it?
Good guess, but no, Mike. The trifilar winding, Brandon, is one of two things. It's either a toroid being used with three separate windings, all the same number of turns. That's one way of using trifilar winding of the toroid. The other way is that the primary and secondary are going to have a 2-to-1 turns ratio. So either the primary is going to have two wires in series, and the third wire is used by itself for the secondary, or vice versa. The primary is one winding, and the two remaining wires are put in secondary, put in series, to make a secondary with twice the number of turns. So trifilar is going to have either three windings or two windings with a 2-to-1 winding ratio between primary and secondary. And so somewhere in the article, it should tell you something about which winding needs more inductance or more turns, and that'll give you a hint as to how to wire between the three wires, how to connect the three wires together, two of them together, for the trifilar wound toroid. Over to you on that one, Brandon. KB1THM, with some delay for IRLP, K2RIW.
Oh, okay, Rich. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay. So you're hooking those second two wires. You're hooking the start of the first one to the, the finish of the first one to the start of that that next one to create twice the length. Okay, I see what you're saying there. Now, what is the advantage to doing it like that as opposed to, say twice as long or three times as long, just wrapping that around the toroid? What's the advantage to, say, either twisting them together first in that manner or simply maybe winding them very close together, laying flat? Either way, what would be the advantage to that?
Let's say now the trifilar wound toroid, needs twice the number of turns on the primary versus the secondary. And if I didn't wind it in a trifilar manner, if I just took a long piece of wire and wound the right number of turns for the primary, I might start the toroid winding at 12 o'clock and end at 3 o'clock with the number of turns on the primary. And then the secondary winding, I'd start at 3 o'clock with half the number of turns and end up at 4:30. So now those windings are displaced along the perimeter of the toroid. Therefore, the amount of coupling between primary and secondary in the ferrite material will be a little bit different than if you used trifilar winding, and now each of the turns of the primary and each of the turns of the secondary are really on top of each other with a twisted trifilar bundle before you wound it. So you get tighter coupling between the individual windings when you use the trifilar and quadrifilar method. That's part of what's going on. And so
more predictable, the right number of turns, better coupling. Everything's in one spot. In the most ideal world, the trifuller bundle, you twist those three leads together, then wind the trifuller bundle the right number of turns on the toroid, and maybe you start that winding at 12 o'clock, and the first few turns get you over to 3 o'clock, the next few turns get you to 6 o'clock, the next few turns get you to 9 o'clock, and you end up at 11:30 with the last turn of the trifuller bundle. That would be the most ideal way of using the whole perimeter of the toroid in a predictable manner as far as interwinding capacitance is concerned, interwinding inductance, stray reactance of the toroid. Everything becomes more predictable with the trifuller technique as opposed to using individual wires longer and shorter and different number of turns. Does that make some sense there, Brandon? KD1, THM, K2RIW.
Yeah, Rich, that actually does make sense. Okay. Again, very good explanation. This is all pretty new to me. I'm fairly new to, let's say, any electronics building. So this is all very helpful. I really appreciate it. I'm on a bit of a filter building kick right now. I'm attempting to assemble a couple for use in our club's field day. So just to keep the radios from interfering with each other on the harmonic frequencies. So, Rich, again, I just want to say thank you for your answer, and also thank you for everything you do. This TechNet's very fascinating to listen to. Back to you.
And would you believe this TechNet began in 1982 in September? And it's been under, for the most part, one leadership all of that time, although a couple of people have come and gone. Okay, I think we've got... John had an additional question, if I remember correctly, and maybe Joe's got another one. WA2VDH, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah, just a quick question. It really has to do with you and AIL. Back in the late 70s, SUNY Farmingdale had a work-study program with Airborne Instrument Laboratories. We would have some students take morning classes and then have a work session at AIL in the afternoon, and we had also an afternoon section where they would work in the morning. I was just wondering, while you was at AIL, did you ever interact with any of those work-study students? And if you did, what was their opinion about it? What was your opinion about them? Go ahead.
During my 35 years at AIL, 1964 to 2000, 35 and a half years, yeah, I interviewed a whole lot of engineering candidates. I did not directly interface with the students. However, I talked to engineers who did interface with the students, and they seemed to be very pleased with them. And a significant number of those students eventually became AIL employees. So depending on how well they integrated, AIL was a fascinating place to work for. It really was a research facility that had a little bit of manufacturing characteristics, because when you built something for Army, Navy, Air Force, or whatever, you almost always built a number of them. They were not very much into commercial products. There was a commercial arm called AIL Tech, or Microwave Instruments Division, which I worked for a while, building spectrum analyzers, but that was a small department at AIL compared to the rest of the company. The rest of the company was primarily military-oriented, research and development, and then supply X number of those units to the military. So because of its research laboratory-like characteristics, those students in general, as long as they had a technical interest. They really like the place and they wanted to work there.